Responsible eating, responsible eating, responsible eating and living.
Hello, I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to Ask a Vegan. It's May 20th, 2012. Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, wherever you are, whenever you're listening. It's a beautiful evening here in New York City, and I'm really looking forward to this next hour. I am here with the creative director of Responsible Eating and Living, my nonprofit organization, and his name is Gary DeMattei. We're going to turn the tables around, and he's going to be interviewing me.
That's right, I am. Good evening, everyone. Good afternoon, as Karen said, or good morning, depending on where it is you are. And we do have an international following here at Responsible Eating and Living. So if you are listening from a place outside of the United States, thank you.
Merci. Danke schön.
For tuning in. Grazie. Gracias. And all of that. And so tonight we thought, because we're approaching our year anniversary here at Responsible Eating and Living, and we thought it'd be kind of fun to talk to the founder, Karen Hartglass, ask her a few questions, because she is the guru of the vegan movement in my world. And when I was transitioning about 5 years ago to a plant-based diet, I riddled Karen with questions about how I was going to be able to survive this type of lifestyle. And it is a lifestyle. It's, you're not only deciding to change what you eat, but you're also deciding to live a lifestyle that's a little bit different than the conventional lifestyle that many of us are used to living. And so without any further ado, I am going to be speaking with the founder, Karen Hartglass, of Responsible Eating and Living. So, Karen, how are you this evening?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm terrific. Now, we might have some new listeners out there, so let's start at the very beginning. Where were you born?
I was born in New York, in Westchester County, a little place called Bronxville.
Bronxville. Is that in the Bronx?
It's Bronxville, so it's a little north of the Bronx.
So you could conceivably say that you were born in the Bronx.
No, I was not born in New York City. And it's just a little north of there, upstate. It's called Bronxville in Westchester County.
Okay. You have to forgive me because I'm from Northern California. And if I hear the word Bronx, I automatically assume that you were born in the Bronx.
Yeah, it's very close.
Okay. And so now, were you raised in Bronxville or did you move?
When I was about 3 and a half, we moved to Long Island, the suburbs.
Ah, so you were raised in the suburbs of Long Island.
Absolutely. It was the sticks back then. And there are still some sticks, but there's a lot more development since I first moved there.
Okay, so let's get to the interesting part of the interview. What did you eat when you were being raised in the sticks of Long Island?
Yeah, well, I think I ate a pretty standard American diet. This was in the early 60s when I was growing up, and we'd start typically with a box cereal. I had some favorites back then.
Breakfast.
Sugar Frosted Flakes, Captain Crunch, Raisin Bran was probably the most sensible, and I liked it. Shredded Wheat, Frosted Mini Wheats came later. That was fun.
And what did you pour on this dry cereal?
Milk. Cow's milk.
Cow's milk. Okay.
Absolutely. And at first it was the kind that was delivered to our home. Do you remember that when bottles were delivered
to
the door?
Sure.
And then, but pretty much that didn't last very long. And our milk we got at the store, the supermarket, and then it went from full fat to skim milk became popular, and then the low fat versions.
Okay, so then you obviously went to school. What school did you go to? What grammar school did you attend, in case anybody who also went to that grammar school is listening?
Well, we called it elementary school.
Elementary school. Okay.
We didn't call it grammar school. I'm not sure if that's an East Coast, West Coast thing
or whatever it is. Yeah, I'm sure it's just
I went to was called Sweet Hollow.
Sweet Hollow. Sounds like something from a Broadway musical, Sweet Apple. Okay, so you went to Sweet Hollow Elementary School, and you packed a lunch, or did you eat in the cafeteria?
Well, we did a little bit of both, but I remember the packed lunches being really boring, and I don't want to blame my mom for this, but back then the classic lunch was a white bread, and there was a choice usually of salami, bologna, maybe some mustard on the sandwich, not much else, and a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, sometimes a cream cheese and jelly sandwich, or American cheese with lettuce and tomato. I remember these sandwiches being really dry and not inspiring.
Got it.
And I don't think there was really much else in the lunchbox. We'd get milk from the cafeteria. And then the other option was to buy lunch in the cafeteria. And I remember the rectangular-shaped pizzas with a little bit of cheese on them. We had spaghetti and meatball. I don't really remember what else we had.
Great. And so dinner, obviously, when you got home.
My mom was pretty good at making dinner. And my dad would come home around 5:30 and we'd all look forward to sitting down at the table. And I think that was a really good thing, sitting around the table and having our food pretty much homemade. But we ate a lot of meatloaf, hamburgers. Sometimes we'd have frozen fish sticks.
Mm-hmm.
Or
so it's safe to say that you were not raised vegan or vegetarian.
Absolutely not.
Okay, that was what I was getting at. So Karen Hartglass, founder of Responsible Eating and Living, was not always a vegan.
Well, I think most of the vegans in this country were not raised. There are only a handful of people that were born vegan and are lifetime vegans.
Especially,
I think there are more of them today, but there's not very many.
Especially when we're talking about baby boomers and post-baby boomers, am I correct? I mean,
yeah.
Now I think it's probably a little more common, even though it's not very common. Okay, so my whole idea of asking you these questions, in addition to maybe there are some folks out there that didn't know this information, was to get at the important question is, when did you decide to become a vegetarian?
Yeah,
How old were you?
This is a funny story that I've told many times, but I was about 15 and I was in high school, and I remembered one of my friends coming in and announcing that he was a vegetarian. And that was just a switch for me. The light went on. I never thought about it before. And we were raised with the philosophy of helping others that were less fortunate. My sister and I would do fundraisers in our backyard for cancer research, a variety of other things. So we were definitely raised with helping and doing good and serving, but I never thought about what was going on with animals. And as soon as I heard the word vegetarian, I just didn't want to kill animals anymore. I came home and announced, I'm not eating meat.
So it really wasn't any graphic films or posters that you saw. It was just a friend of yours in high school saying to you, I'm a vegetarian, and the light switch went on for you.
Yeah, well, this was the early 70s, and we didn't have the internet, and I didn't know of any films or books or anything.
Great. So this is fascinating. Now, how long were you a vegetarian? And two questions, and what was your family's reaction to this? Because there might be some young people out there today that are maybe interested in becoming vegetarian and maybe are stopping themselves from doing it because they're afraid of possibly the reaction that they're going to get from their parents.
Absolutely. So I think it's easier today because there's so much information out on the internet. There are more books that have been written on the subject. There's more cookbooks. There's internet shows and podcasts and all kinds of places you can go to for kids, for teenagers, and for parents. But at that time, when I told my parents I didn't want to eat meat anymore, they were really concerned. They asked the classic questions that you hear over and over and over and over and over, which is, you have to get your protein. And
that meant meat, right?
Yeah, because somehow we've all been kind of programmed. And the more I read about nutrition and the more I read about the history of food, I've learned that we haven't really known much about nutrition. I think most people still don't know much about nutrition, but during that time, people didn't know anything about nutrition. They heard about this buzzword protein and how important it was, and you had to get it, and you got it from meat. And we were all marketed. by companies and by the government to think that way.
Yeah, a lot of us, and still are to this day, are considered market shares. We're not considered human beings. So I agree with you there. So you told your family, your mother and father, your sister and your brother, that you were going to be a vegetarian. Did anyone else jump on the vegetarian movement with you, or was it just you? Were you going solo in your family?
At first, I was alone. And
how was that?
Well, you know, I'm not shy.
Right.
And I was never afraid of controversy or being different. My dad used to call me Contrary Karen.
Right.
And so I was off doing my own thing. And we had some lively discussions around the dinner table with family, with friends. And I found so often that people would go on the defensive and get really angry at me.
Right.
And, you know, I was just a little girl. I didn't want it. But
as if you didn't know any better, right?
I don't know. And it was a journey. And so what happened was fortunately, when I went to college, they had a vegetarian meal plan. It wasn't vegan, and I didn't know about being vegan at the time, but that certainly made things easier. I was still eating fish occasionally because I didn't make that connection that fish was flesh.
You know, that's fascinating. Let's talk about that. Why do you think, I know a lot of vegetarians and folks out there claiming to be vegetarians, and when I ask them, oh, so you don't eat any meat, and they would always follow up and say, no, I don't eat meat, but I eat a little fish.
Right.
And so I'm wondering, why do you think they make the connection with that?
Why do you think they make it or don't make it?
Don't make it.
Well, to start with, I think if we're going to connect with animals, the ones that we're going to connect with most are mammals. The ones that don't look like us, but look more like us than any other animals. Certainly dogs and cats, you know, when we see their sweet little eyes looking up at us, there's a connection.
Yeah, I think my psychology teacher in college called that endearing qualities. We seem to be drawn to those looks of innocence in puppies and kitties and even some farm animals.
Right.
And so, but I also know some people that look kind of like fish. So so if you're a vegetarian and you say you don't eat meat, but you eat fish, what is that called?
It's not a vegetarian.
No.
And, you know, I don't want to get hung up on semantics. If you're eliminating animal products, that's a good thing.
Right.
If you're not eating beef, if you decide not to eat chicken and you're eating some fish, you know, that's better than
right
eating more animals.
Okay, so let's talk about, you mentioned college. So you left high school as a vegetarian and you went to college as a vegetarian.
Mm-hmm.
They have a vegetarian meal plan. Obviously, you were staying in the dorms, and so there was a commissary area or a cafeteria area where you went and got your meals, and they had a vegetarian plan. What
right.
college did you go to?
That was Bucknell University.
Bucknell University. Is that in Pennsylvania?
It is.
Oh, fantastic. And let's backtrack a little bit. What high school did you go to? I'm sure you have a lot of listeners out there. Half Hollow Hills High School. And what type of high school? What's the population of Half Hollow Hills?
Well, I don't know what it is now, but my graduating class, there were 876.
Okay, so 15 years old, you're in Half Hollow Hills High School. A friend of yours says he's vegetarian, or she says she's vegetarian. You become a vegetarian. And was there any other vegetarians that you knew at Half Hollow Hills High School before you left for college?
I don't remember.
How about once you got to college?
Yeah, there were a few. There were certainly enough to participate in the meal plan.
Great. So what kind of things did you eat at the Bucknell University cafeteria?
Well, this was a long time ago, and I certainly didn't know a lot about nutrition. So we had a lot of loafs.
Right.
Different loafs made from beans and grains, usually with some kind of cheese on them.
So a loaf meaning like we would call it if you eat meat, you would call it a meat loaf. But if you don't eat meat, you would call it a bean loaf, a lentil loaf.
It was
loaf,
a very grainy.
A grain loaf?
Grainy nut
okay.
loaf. I think primarily because they were easy.
Okay, this is, you know, this is an interesting thing because as you know and as I know, because we both work with a lot of the recipes and things that are up on the responsibleeatingandliving.com website, vegetarian, vegan cooking has really
evolved.
Yeah, amen. And so when you were in college, and without revealing your age to us, was this in the 70s or 80s?
I'm 54.
I didn't want to say anything. Well, you're certainly a young 54.
I was in school from 1976 to 1980, and I really only used the cafeteria the first year I was there. I went off campus afterwards and started making my own meals.
So the food was basically pretty boring, the vegetarian meal plan.
There were a lot of sides and other things you could get. I think they did a pretty good job back then.
Great.
I was happy with it.
Okay. And so you went off campus.
But there wasn't any soy milk or anything like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, but you were...
I wasn't vegan at the time either.
Okay. So you stayed vegetarian how long?
Well, it wasn't until I was 30 that I went vegan. And it was primarily, again, from ignorance where I really didn't know what was going on. A lot of people decide not to eat meat because they don't want to kill animals. And they think that eating eggs and drinking milk and having dairy products is okay because the animals are happily grazing and living a nice life. And it's okay to take those products. And then I learned two big things. One is, I learned that dairy products are not healthy for humans. Cow milk is for a baby cow to grow, or a baby bovine and a calf to become a large animal in a short amount of time. And other thing was that I learned that a number of things. Number one, there is killing involved, unfortunately. The only way you can have milk is to make a cow pregnant. And then the cow has the calf, and typically if the cow is male, it'll become a veal calf. If it's female, it usually becomes another dairy cow, and then the cow does not live as long as it naturally would if it wasn't being exploited like this. And so when the dairy cow doesn't give enough milk anymore, it usually becomes hamburger.
Right. So the veil was lifted for you at 30 years old, and you said, enough. I don't want to consume anything that comes from an animal. And for listeners out there who do not know the difference between a vegetarian and a vegan, is it safe to say that the difference between a vegetarian and a vegetarian and a vegan is that a vegan does not eat anything that comes from an animal, nor do they wear anything that comes from an animal, nor do they use products that come from an animal.
Right. It's more of a lifestyle, and it has to do with not wanting to exploit any sentient being. So where vegetarians don't eat flesh, and that means meat from a cow, a pig, a sheep, a chicken, a turkey, a duck, fish.
Even honey. Some vegans will not eat honey, correct?
We're talking about vegetarian. And then the vegans don't eat dairy or eggs, or the official definition is no honey. But there are people that eat honey and say they're vegan. And again, I don't want to get into semantics. I think it's great when people decide to eliminate animal products. And if they're going to eat a little honey, I don't want to spend time talking about that. I don't think that's the big picture. And then the other part of it is all of the animal products that are used in our personal products, our soaps, our detergents, cleaning products, our makeup and shampoos. Animal products are everywhere, even in plastics.
Right. Now let's stop with that and parallel this conversation with, at this time you decided to go vegan, what was your profession? What were you doing for a living?
Okay, I was a chemical engineer.
Yes,
I was. Well, I went to Bucknell and I got a master's in chemical engineering.
You got a master's in chemical engineering. Wow,
and
that's
I went
off.
First I started out working at a titanium dioxide manufacturing plant in Delaware with DuPont. I did that for about a year and a half, and I really didn't like it. And I had this calling to go out to California
Right.
It could have been because I watched all of those Lucy episodes when I was really young, and there was right. the California, right. here I come.
Right. Lucy.
No, yeah. And so I packed up my car literally and drove out to California.
And how old were you when you went to California?
At 24.
24. Okay. So you stayed in California how long?
About 9 years.
9 years.
And I worked as an engineer, and I also did some professional opera and musical theater.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about that. So in addition to having a master's degree from Bucknell University in chemical engineering and working for DuPont and then deciding to move out to California, you also are a classically trained singer. And
yes, I am!
And you are an actor. Actress. I don't like using the term actress, but
I'm an actor.
You're an actor and an opera singer, and you've performed in musical theater and opera all around the world, actually, right? I mean, you spent mm-hmm. some time in Germany. And you met me in California.
Yes, I did.
And we did a show together. We did a musical together. We did an opera together.
Light opera, yeah. Baker's Opera.
Right, and so that's how we met, and then we parted ways and then came back together again, and we have a really lovely story, you and I, but we're not going to talk about that this time around. We're going to talk more about you, and then we can interview me and you later.
Okay.
When we get something else going on. But I just want to let the folks out there who are listening know that I'm asking these questions and acting surprised when Karen gives me answers that I already know, but this is to be polite to you and not assume that you also know these things. So, 30 years old, you're a vegan. Who talked you into being a vegan?
Right. Well, at that time, I was just picking up whatever material I could. And I remember reading the Vegetarian Resource Journal, which was one of the very few publications that came out at the time, Vegetarian Times Magazine. Vegetarian Times Magazine wasn't really telling me much about the dairy industry, but the Vegetarian Resource Journal did, and that led me to anything else that I could find, and I was mulling over this for months. It was really bothering me, and I was also reading about how the consumption of dairy could affect women in terms of their health and in terms of their menstrual cycles.
Yeah, so let's talk about that a minute, because that's, I know, an important topic with you, and I'd like you to sort of give us an appraisal of what you feel dairy contributes to with respect to...
It's interesting because fast forward to now, looking back, I understand so much more than I did then. So when I was a teenager, it's now clear to me that I was not well. I was not healthy. I felt pretty good. But when I started menstruating, I had a very, very heavy period that was not natural. So something already was wrong. And I'm going to assume either it was genetic or I think it had to do with my diet. I was eating a lot of dairy.
And now, when you say a lot of dairy, you're also including cheese.
Cheese and ice cream and milk and butter.
Right.
I like to cook, and I like to cook with dairy products. And it affects people differently, but I think it wasn't good for me.
Right.
And there are studies now that show that people that consume more animal products, especially dairy products, mature faster, and girls are maturing faster and menstruating earlier. I've read that the real age girls should start menstruating at is around 17, and right. the average is around 11 or 12, and some even earlier.
Yes, and I know as far as boys are concerned, there's a serious what's the word?
They get acne.
They get acne, right? Just trying to be polite. But that also affects, obviously, women as well. But so dairy does not do a body good. Would it be
so? No, and so looking back in hindsight, I'm realizing that dairy was related to a lot of my future health problems. And one thing led to another. So I had a problem. I had a heavy flow. And as a result, I used a lot of tampons, and tampons have dioxin in them. And I was probably using more than necessary and getting larger doses than were expected for typical use of tampons. And so I think I got a very large dose of dioxin in my very young body. And
which you feel has maybe contributed to what happened to you later in life, which
was... when I was 48, I was diagnosed with advanced ovarian cancer.
Right. And, okay, so we'll talk a little bit more about that in
but
a minute.
One thing, but what happened when I was 30 and I eliminated dairy from my diet...
Yes, that's what I was going to get back to.
The physical feeling was crystal clear.
Right.
I did not have any tenderness during the menstrual cycle, and my mood, I didn't have any mood changes.
Right. Okay. Well, I know, speaking from personal experience, when I became a vegan about 6 years ago now, I had a tremendous change in my energy level as well. And when I kicked dairy and meat and animal products, I still don't know how I got so much energy at 50. And so I think dairy really does slow you down. I think animal products slow you down. So I'm also responsible. When I was a meat eater, I know I joke with you about this, that I was probably one of the major contributors to global warming because I ate so much meat. But the important thing to remember is we're going to be discussing in this next half hour transitioning to a plant-based diet and some of the things that come up that you encountered over 20 years ago when you became a vegan that weren't there for you. As you just mentioned, there was a magazine and there was a journal, but now there's so much more. And one of the forces in information for people now is responsibleeatingandliving.com. It's a great website. It's a great resource. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that in the next half hour. And if you have any calls or questions that you would like to give us, Karen, how can people get in touch with us and ask us their questions?
Okay. Anytime during the program or anytime during the week, you can send an email to info@realmeals.org. I love to hear from you about anything. Comments on the show, questions you have. I get a lot of fun questions, and so that's a great way. The other thing is, if you want to talk to us and be on the show, it's really easy. You go to Skype.com. If you've already registered at Skype, you can just look for Ask a Vegan and connect with us here on the show. If you're not registered, you'll have to create an account, and then you can connect with us. You can find us by putting in the search bar Ask a Vegan, all one word. You can put in Responsible Eating and Living. There's numerous ways to find us on
right.
Skype.
And it's a great night for you to ask questions because you not only have a vegan of – how many years have you been a vegan now?
Oh, gosh. Since 1988. So what's the – 24 years.
24 years. You also have a vegan who is only about 6 years old. So I have a lot more
6 years old.
A lot more information for those of you who are thinking about transitioning but aren't sure how you're going to survive. Trust me, once you pick up a few – of the tips that we have at responsibleeatingandliving.com that we can sort of talk you through in person, it really becomes, as I mentioned earlier, the veil is lifted and everything all of a sudden starts to make sense, not only with how you feel, but how food tastes and how your body reacts to the change. It's a very positive change. And again, I ate a lot of meat and a lot of dairy. And so ask us some questions. But now we're going to press on into the world of transitioning to a plant-based diet and what that means to you and how responsible eating and living can help. Just because I direct a lot of the programming on the website, meaning that if we have a food show, I'm usually the guy behind the camera and in the editing room. We also do a lot of on-site visits to a lot of different places, and you'll find a lot of video content on the website. You'll also find over 160 interviews with doctors and chefs, nutritionists, authors that are at the top of their field with respect to the movement. Not all of them are vegan, so if some of you out there are vegetarian or you're thinking about maybe, you know, not eating meat on Mondays and you want some ideas about some new dishes for Meatless Mondays in your life, the site can help you there. But mainly, as Karen was mentioning earlier, there wasn't a whole lot of information out there when she was transitioning to a plant-based diet. And so it was kind of easier to sift through the information. And now it's getting more and more difficult. And you're not sure if people are trying to sell you something or if this is really truthful information. Well, the one thing that you can count on here at Responsible Eating and Living is that this is the truth about a plant-based diet and transitioning to it. We're not trying to sell you anything. We are a nonprofit 501c3, which means that, you know, we do this on the premise that we need to be truthful because we have a higher power to answer to, and that is you out there, the listener. We don't have a big corporation or a big board of directors that's breathing down our necks to sell you products. We are a small organization that survives basically from writing grants, and let's toot our horn a little bit. As recently as yesterday, right?
Friday, I got a check from Enterprise Holdings, and Enterprise Holdings is the foundation that it's a larger corporation that includes Enterprise Rent-A-Car, and I think National and some other car companies are in that. And
that was a grant that you wrote to the Enterprise Holdings organization.
Yeah, and I picked up the check on Friday, which was really exciting.
And it was a whopping check.
Oh yeah,
it was huge.
It was a nice amount. Definitely a nice amount. I learned from someone that works at Enterprise that they gift grants to employees who want to contribute to the community. So it's an employee that has to submit the application for the nonprofit. And what's especially nice is that the person that did this for Responsible Eating and Living, he is himself on a health transition path.
Right. And he's an incredibly nice guy.
Nice guy. And I'm always there to answer his questions. And he's recently discovered kale and can't say enough.
You mean kale as in the green leafy vegetable?
Yeah,
kale?
Oh, that's the interesting. King of green leafies, you know, and he's experiencing all this energy and weight loss and all kinds of great things are happening.
And of course, I don't want to sound like we're launching into any pledge drive here, but another way that we survive here at Responsible Eating and Living is from donations from listeners and viewers of our food shows like you. So if you're interested in a tax-deductible donation, you can find out how to do that. How, Karen?
You just go to ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com and click on the donation tab. That will take you to a form that you fill out. You put your information in and how much you want to donate, and that will take you to PayPal and take care of the rest.
Right. And as I mentioned earlier in this broadcast, we are going to be celebrating our year anniversary.
In July.
And we had something really wonderful happen to us, speaking of magazines. What happened right after we launched in July?
Oh, gosh, right. It was in November. We were featured in Veg News Best of 2011 issue as one of 10 nonprofits you need to know. You know, I wanted to get back to where you were talking about my podcast, my interviews with over 160 athletes, chefs, authors, activists, nutritionists. Something that's really important to me is to move forward our understanding of healthy food. And where I come from, I'm a vegan, and certainly I would love to see a peaceful world where nobody was killing anything for anything. I don't know that I'm ever going to see something like that, but I definitely encourage people to eat more fruits and vegetables. But there are a number of things where many of us can align our missions. And so there are people that don't want to be vegan, but they want to have organic food, food that doesn't have genetically modified organisms in it, food that isn't grown with pesticides and herbicides. And so there are many organizations that can work together on similar issues. We may not agree on everything, but it's so important to team up together because there's strength in numbers. And so I talked to a number of people that are not vegetarian or vegan on my show. Most recently, I spoke with Aaron Bobrow Strain, who wrote a book about the history of white bread, and it was fascinating.
Right.
And really helped me understand more how we got to where we are today. And one of the things I learned was what people eat today, at least in the United States, is nothing like what we ate in history. And this particular author talked about how people got 30% of their calories during some different periods in time from bread. And they weren't eating a varied diet of lots of different things. And so, you know, there are some things that people think we can't live without or we have to eat. And it really comes from very limited knowledge of what humans have been eating over thousands of years.
Right. And, you know, ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com and these 160-plus podcasts that you have are actually interviews. Don't take place here at ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com. They take place where, Karen?
At the Progressive Radio Network,
right,
which is PRN.FM, every Wednesday live from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. And you can find out more about that on ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com. But there's more podcasts than that because we've been doing the Ask a Vegan show for
right,
a couple of years.
And there's a lot of information on the Ask a Vegan podcasts as well. But I just wanted to clarify that here at Responsible Eating and Living, even though we are only a year, not even quite a year old yet, we are starting to make significant changes in the way we do programming here. For example, this podcast that you're listening to now, this is a new edition, and we're working on a lot of different things. And so your tax-deductible donations will go to help support our mission to continue to grow and expand, and we're currently developing programs for not only the radio, but we're developing programs for television, and we're developing programs to bring into the schools. We're getting ready to write lots of grants because this is the big time of year to, well, it's actually every day of the week is a big time of year, but this is a really, summer approaching is a really important time to start your fundraising drive. So anything you can do or any help you can give us by spreading the word would be greatly appreciated. Now, getting back to the fact that it's going to be summer, there's a lot of things that are happening, and some of you might be thinking, well, this might be a good time to try a plant-based diet. Maybe I want to give it a go.
Well, it's a good time because the more food is fresh.
Right, and I was just going to great segue into what's happening now is there's lots of farmers markets and things around, and there's lots of ways you can get fresh organic produce, and I know that we have several here in New York City, and I'm sure there's some in your neck of the woods if you're listening out there.
We just found out we're going to have a new farmers market here in Forest Hills.
And why are those so important now? I mean, why are these local farmers markets popping up all around the world such a great sign?
I'm always talking about how we need to change the world with what we consume and what we purchase. And when people are feeling...
it's all about food, right?
It's all about food.
I mean, that's really... That statement and title of one of your shows is really the truth.
You know,
it?
We've got a presidential election coming up, and it's really quite sad and comical what goes on in the political world. And people feel so helpless. But every one of us can make a difference. And we make a difference with our dollar, with what we purchase. And so most of our food today is grown by a few corporations, agribusiness, giant agribusiness, where
right,
food is grown with petrochemical fertilizers, pesticides, and herbicides. And petrochemicals, of course, come from
now,
oil.
For those people listening who don't, like me, who don't know what petrochemical means, what is a petrochemical?
Yeah, well, that comes from the oil that's under the ground, the same thing we use for our gasoline to power our homes and factories. And we know that that's not an unlimited resource. There are limited supplies. And so as the cost of oil goes up, the cost of food comes up, not just because we ship it crazy places all around the world, but also because we use petrochemicals for fertilizer, herbicides, and pesticides.
And what is an herbicide?
An herbicide is...
Roundup would be considered an herbicide?
Yes. It's something that kills plants.
Right.
So we kind of discriminate between plants. There are good plants and there are bad plants. And the bad plants
we
are...
We sort of do that with animals too, though, don't we?
Yeah,
don't
we do. We discriminate everything.
We sort of compartmentalize our animals.
And so the plants that we don't like, we call them weeds.
Mm-hmm. But they're anything but weeds.
Well, the daffodil, the dandelion, for example, was brought over by the Europeans because they liked it as a salad green. And now it's become a weed in many people's lawns. And a lot of chemicals are used to kill those dandelions. Except now in some of the farmers markets today and in more of the trendy health food stores, people are buying dandelion greens because they're flavorful and they're nutritious.
Yeah, I was raised, I'm a second generation Italian-American, raised by first generation Italians, and many of my relatives used to pull over at when they saw a vacant lot as if they were discovering gold and go out and pick mustard greens. And it would be, you know, there'd be a condemned building and there'd be a billboard falling down, but there'd be this great big field of mustard greens and they'd go out there and it was like they discovered gold basically. And so they'd fill the car with these mustard greens. It was very embarrassing, but you know, I now understand why, because I mean, we have a great recipe on our website for mustard greens. So they're delicious, very tasty. Saute them with a little olive oil, a little garlic, but to boil them first, make sure you boil them first. And I know there's probably some raw foodists out there who are probably cringing right now, so I apologize. But
You can eat mustard greens raw. They're
sure.
Really hot and spicy, so I like to mix
you can
it
juice
in
them even,
greens.
Right?
Yeah.
You could.
There's lots of different greens out there.
So it truly is all about food here at Responsible Eating and Living. And what I want to get back to, though.
We were talking about farmers markets.
Farmers markets. I want to get back to, because
so
you can find a lot of mustard greens and, as you said, dandelion greens at a lot of these farmers markets. But I think what we need to make here is a distinction on why it's really important to buy locally in addition to trying to buy locally and organic. Why is that?
Well, let's just talk about nutrition right now.
Right.
And Americans are not well. Our health care costs are high, and over 600,000 people die of heart disease every year. We have a diabetes epidemic and obesity epidemic. People need to eat better and get more nutritious food. And one of the problems is that our food is grown by giant corporations with herbicides and pesticides, toxic chemicals. The food is harvested. The food is packaged or shipped around the country. And every step takes time. And by the time your, quote, fresh produce gets to the supermarket, it's not fresh anymore. It's old. Some of it can be in a warehouse for a while until the price settles into where businesses want to sell their produce. A lot of our produce is not fresh, and every day, every hour that produce is available after it's been picked, it loses nutrition. So when we buy produce from a farmer's market or from community supported agriculture, which I can talk about in a minute, you're getting the next best thing to growing it yourself and just picking it and eating it, because the farmers pretty much harvest what they're going to sell the night before or that morning and bring it to market. So you're getting the freshest possible food you can, which means the highest nutrition possible.
I know you're going to talk about community supported agriculture, and I'm excited to hear about your feelings on community supported agriculture. And so how can people find out about the farmers markets in their area?
Well, you know what? Everybody's online right now listening to this show. It's a simple Google search, but I know in New York we have a number of organizations. We have Green Market, and we have justfood.org. So justfood.org lists all of the community supported agriculture groups in New York City. And this is a concept that came from Japan, and it's It's wonderful. It eliminates the middleman. And what happens is a local farmer will connect with a community and give a price for shares. And people will pay at the beginning of the growing season. Maybe it's $500, $600. It depends on your area. And that gives the farmer money to buy seed and all the other things that the farmer will need to grow the season, and also gives the farmer an idea of how many customers there will be.
Right. It's really a wonderful, wonderful.
And then what happens is during the harvest season, which is typically May until November, you get a box of freshly picked food. You don't always know what you're going to get. Typically, each farmer will have a website and kind of give you an idea of what will be in your box that week. Very often they come with recipes and,
yes, that's really neat. It's fun because
a lot of times you get things that you've never tried before.
Let's talk about recipes. I mean, I know I've keep mentioning ad nauseum the fact that we have several recipes on the website.
We have over 120, I think, right now.
Right, and then you've also interviewed hundreds of
chefs. There are so many wonderful vegan
authors,
cookbooks out today,
and some are coming up on your show. I know. I remember listening to. The co-author of The Skinny Bitch. How do you pronounce Kim's last name?
I think it's Kim Barnuen.
Yeah, I thought it was fascinating. She's got a great book out. And let's see.
Her latest book is Skinny Bitch, Book of Vegan Swaps. And I talked to her in March.
Right. And, you know, just looking through her book here, which I'm sure she wouldn't mind us giving her a plug.
A plug.
And, you know, as far as a transitioning vegan, which I still consider myself a transitioning vegan, even though I haven't eaten any meat or dairy or anything from an animal in over 5 years, 6 years. She has, right at the beginning of the book, she has things that I would have found very helpful, and I didn't really have a list of those then. I just had you as my main resource. But she talks about natural food retailers, and that's the subject that we're talking about now. She talks about all sorts of things, and especially I know that when I was a transitioning vegan, there's always this fear you have about going out to dinner. And in her book, and I know we could talk a little bit about that, she gives lists of restaurants and things like that, and that could be very, very well in your area. And one restaurant in particular that I touched on in her book was a favorite of mine in San Francisco, and that's the Herbivore, the Earthly Grill Cafe.
Oh yeah, I love that restaurant.
That's a great restaurant. And another one in San Francisco, and this ties in with the first cookbook that I really found extremely helpful, and you, Karen, turned me on to it, was the Millennium Cookbook, which is the famous vegetarian, or is it a vegan restaurant?
It's a vegan restaurant. I remember when the Millennium first came out. Gosh, it must have been the early 90s, I think. And before that, we had Greens in San Francisco,
right,
which is a vegetarian restaurant. And it was a little frustrating. And I'm surprised, still to this day, the Greens restaurant is not happy to be vegan friendly. They've been like kind of fighting the whole vegan thing all along. I remember going and asking back in the early 90s, you know, can I get rice without butter on it? And they were like, no, you can't. Things have changed, and they definitely offer some vegan alternatives. But
no
then,
substitutions.
But when the Millennium arrived, it was a wonderful thing because here was the first that I experienced of fine vegan dining. The
right.
Atmosphere was gorgeous. It was in another location. It has since moved to a newer place, but beautiful place, really lovely dishes.
And, you know, you can ask us here at ResponsibleEatingAndLiving.com to give you suggestions of veg or vegan restaurants in your neighborhood, too. We have ways to get you the information. another great restaurant along the Millennium Lines is here in New York City, and I can't do this broadcast with you without plugging Candle 79 and the Candle Cafe people. They're just phenomenal.
And the newest candle restaurant on the West Side, Candle Cafe West.
Yeah, and Joy and Bart are just two of the most wonderful people you'll ever want to meet, and oftentimes you'll find them in the restaurants, and those are the owners.
Hugging and kissing everybody.
Right. And so, but, you know, there's some of the bigger chains, and in this book, Skinny Bitch, Book of Vegan Swaps, which we were discussing about, Kim talks about some of the vegan swaps. Like, for example, P.F. Chang's is a big chain, and probably a lot of you have a P.F. Chang's in your neighborhood. She says, and I'll just read a real quick paragraph about how she kind of gets into it. P.F. Chang's, thanks to the fact that vegans have big mouths and aren't afraid to demand meatless cuisine from P.F. Chang's management, the Chinese chain has a decent selection of vegan options. Plus, the kitchen will convert any meat dish into a vegan one by substituting tofu, five-spice pressed bean curd, and vegetarian oyster sauce. Some of my favorites are the vegetarian lettuce wraps, Kung Pao bean curd, coconut curry vegetables, and Chang's bean curd. Now, I just wanted to read that to you because, again, we'll go back to the beginning of this conversation with Karen Hartglass of Responsible Eating and Living, and that's who you're listening to now, Karen Hartglass and Gary DeMattei. 30 years ago when Karen became a vegetarian slash vegan and, you know, there wasn't a lot of this going on. There was probably more vegan food to be found at a Grateful Dead concert than there was in a restaurant. But now we've really got a lot of restaurants that understand that vegans and vegetarians are going to be coming into their establishments with friends who aren't necessarily vegetarian or vegan, and they're going to be a little more flexible. So it's easier to come out now as a vegan and or a vegetarian, and it's easier to go out with friends and enjoy an evening out on the town. I know that was a big deal for me. I mean, I believe – I haven't been to a Chipotle, but – well, I have been to a Chipotle, and I believe I ordered a vegan – it was on the menu as a vegan burrito. So I know a lot of even the fast food perish the thought and or terminology – restaurants are now even starting to become a little more sensitive.
I just wanted to add, because you reminded me when you were reading about P.F. Chang's, there are hidden ingredients that new vegans and even some seasoned vegans don't realize may be in foods when they go to a restaurant. It's a scary thing, putting your trust in people behind the curtain, behind the wall, making your food. And so let's just run through some of them. In a typical Chinese restaurant, even if you're ordering just vegetables, they are typically sautéed with chicken broth.
Right.
Scary. And then in a Thai food restaurant, even if they say they're vegetarian, there can be fish sauce in the food. And so it's
And in an Indian restaurant, they use lots of ghee, which is...
Oh, yeah. And I remember, I've come up with a new line sometimes, especially in Indian restaurants. I find I have to really repeat it over and over and over where I say, I don't eat dairy, I don't eat cheese, I don't eat butter, no ghee, no ghee, no ghee. I kind of say it several times. And sometimes I have to say, I will die if there's dairy in the food. Because so often I've heard, oh, well, there's just a little butter. And, you know, when you make this choice, it's, you know, for some people, just a little bit won't matter, and that's fine. I just know that I'm at a point where I can taste it. I'm at a point where I can, I can feel it. It may sound a little nutty sometimes, but
no.
When I smell bacon grilling, I can hear pink screaming.
Right.
Okay. No, it may be a little weird, but it kind of opens up that door that we shove down so that we're not really acknowledging the truth and what's going on.
Right. So let's stop there about bacon or how, you know, bacon. For transitioning a former meat eater, it was very important for me to have that taste. And I know that I'm talking to a seasoned veteran here to my right, but, you know, let's be honest. We, you know, I refer to it as the veil being lifted, the light bulb going off, the great aha moment, whatever it is, whatever happens for you when you finally realize that ingesting pain and suffering is not a way you want to continue to live your life. And you know, and we're a market share, so we're really marketed to think that this is just a normal situation to raise animals, kill them, eat them. Okay. So that said, we are hooked on tastes, and a lot of my friends that I know who can't go through the day, and even some of my relatives without a few slices of bacon, let me tell you, there are alternatives out there. There are substitutes, and one of them is this great product that I call it tempeh bacon, but it's a wonderful product called tempeh, and they smoke it. And you know, a lot of you guys out there, I know it's summer now and it's the big barbecue season, and you're thinking, I'm not going vegan, I've got to grill up some food. And, you know, I got to have my steaks. And so I'm not being facetious, but there are alternatives to, and you can keep your grill fired up and you can use it. And one of the things as far as an alternative to bacon is tempeh bacon. It is out there. If you need to know what it looks like or where to find it, just Google or Ping or Chrome or whatever it is you do now, whatever search engine you have, just Google tempeh bacon and you'll probably see some interesting packaging. Cheese, there's another great transition.
You know, I'm glad you brought up cheese, because I've gotten a lot of questions over the years, and I got a bunch of questions recently to the Ask a Vegan show about cheese. And so I wanted to mention there are vegan cheeses in the store. I'm not a particular fan of them.
No, I know you're not.
You like Daiya cheese.
I like the Daiya cheese. I think it's a great product.
And there are some that are...
But again, I'm a transitioning vegan, so I still haven't the sophisticated vegan palate that you have.
That's okay. But there are some cheeses that say soy cheese or rice cheese, and they're not vegan. They have casein in them. I know Trader Joe's has a soy cheese. It's not vegan. It has casein in it.
What is casein? Let's talk about that.
It's a milk protein, and it's like glue. That's what gives the cheese its stringy property that everybody loves about it.
Right.
But we just have a few minutes left, and I wanted to talk
about... Wow, has this flown by, huh?
Yeah, it has. But we have a number of vegan cheese recipes on our website, and whether you like working in the kitchen or not, I really recommend trying out these recipes, because they're really delicious. And what we like to do is we make up a lot and then cut them in small chunks and freeze them so that they last a while and they're available whenever we want them. But one of the magic ingredients in vegan cheese is something called agar-agar, and it's a seaweed, and you can get it in flakes and you can get it in powder, and people are often confused about how much to use, because sometimes it'll say a quarter cup of vegan flakes and they have powder, or vice versa, and you don't know how to substitute one for the other. The best way to do it is to weigh the agar to get the right weight for a recipe, but it's typically a 3-to-1 ratio. So a teaspoon of agar powder is equivalent to a tablespoon or 3 teaspoons of agar flakes. But agar is this magic ingredient, and it's what gels something and get
and then why is it good not to use if you're a vegan, not to use the regular gelatin that's out on the market?
Oh, because regular gelatin is made from animal cartilage, and it's not a vegan product,
right? So it's ground up animal cartilage, right?
Yeah, not very
okay. We have a couple of minutes left. I want to remind you that you can go to responsibleeatingandliving.com and make a tax deductible donation if you so choose. We also want you to know that Karen's show on the Progressive Radio Network, called Ask a Vegan, is every Wednesday.
No, that's called It's All About Food.
Sorry, see, I'm glad you're listening.
That's right.
It's called It's All About Food, and she has guests on, and it's coming up soon is Chef Roberto Martin, or he could pronounce his last name.
Martin,
and he is the personal chef of Ellen DeGeneres and Portia de Rossi. And he has a great book coming out that he's going to be talking about called Vegan Cooking for Carnivores.
Yeah, I'll be talking to him on June 6th.
June 6th. So look forward to that one. And check out the website to find out what the next guest she has is. And it was great interviewing you, Karen. Thanks for allowing me to come into the studio and sit down and chat with you.
Thanks for joining me, Gary. And I hope you'll join me again next week, maybe.
Maybe I will. And
okay.
We'll talk some more.
Here's the real jingle. Thanks for listening.
R-E-A-L. Responsible eating and living.
R-E-A-L.
Real's good for the planet, the inhabitants who need sound advice on the right thing to do
when it comes to good health.
We need facts that are true to choose what to eat and save the planet too. That's responsible eating and living.
You'll find the real tools for you.